Except for several hundred years B.C. up until our present time, the story of the Great Flood has captivated human imagination. And no wonder, it is the account of a universal catastrophe that engulfed all of humanity, with the exception of one man and his family, who were saved by the grace of God. In the book of Genesis, the flood stands as a significant turning point in the history of the world. Up until that point in the Genesis record, the writer deals with remote and distant events that affected all of mankind. But following the flood, we enter into a new era, if you will. There are events that are related, directly affect not so much all of mankind, but now more isolated branches of humanity that are descended from certain characters that are mentioned in the text of Genesis. In chapters 6 through 9, the writer uses a variety of devices to draw our attention to the way that the flood closed one era of human history and opened up another. With the exclusion of births and deaths, no other event in the book of Genesis is dated to such an extraordinary extent as the events of the flood. In fact, some of the most major events in the book of Genesis are not dated at all. The creation, the fall of man, Abel's murder, the Tower of Babel, even the call of Abraham doesn't contain specific dating. And yet, when it comes to the flood, we're given very specific dates, not just to the nearest year at times, but even to the month and the day of the month, as the writer marks the different stages of the flood's development. As we saw in chapters 7 and 8, there are also very specific references to certain periods of time, 7 days, 40 days, 150 days. And all of this combines in the book of Genesis to make the account of the flood stand out as unique. Though there are numerous accounts of the flood that we see throughout various peoples and nations, even on different continents, and there are a number of similarities between them, there are also vast differences between them as well. In the book of Genesis, it is one God who plans and who executes the flood. One God who delivers Noah and his family. In the book of Genesis, it is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob who closes in Noah and the animals. It is that same God who remembers Noah. It is that same God who then brings Noah and his family and the animals out of the ark on the dry land. In the book of Genesis, God is shown to be moral and just in dealing with His creation as mankind is destroyed because of his depravity. We see that in the first half of Genesis chapter 6. But God is also shown to be gracious. He is portrayed in the flood as the gracious rewarder of those who are righteous. Noah is described for us as a blameless man among his contemporaries, a man who has chosen to walk with God. It is emphasized, especially in chapter 7 and 8, how Noah walks in complete and total obedience to God's instructions, and therefore he stands as this bright light in an incredibly dark world. And in chapter 6 and verse 8, we find that Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. After Noah and his family come out of the ark, we see him building an altar and making sacrifices to the same God who had saved him. And it is also here at the same time that we find God exercising his mercy by making a declaration in regard to the earth's preservation and the blessings that he would bring upon its inhabitants. In chapter 8 and verses 21 and 22, God gives the assurance that he would never again curse the ground on account of man. And the reason that he gives is not the one that we would expect. For the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. And thus in what had previously been stated as the reason for the extinction of humanity, and now is declared as God's motive for its preservation. For if God destroyed the earth every time man became involved in blatant sin, then God would constantly be focused on destruction. But tonight we move into Genesis chapter 9. And it is here that we are told of this same God who had saved Noah and his family from the flood. Now making some proclamations as to how at least some aspects of this new life in this new world are to be conducted. And we also find some divine promises that God makes that he will never destroy humanity again with a flood of water. Genesis chapter 9, let's begin our reading in verse 1. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And the fear of you and the terror of you will be on every beast of the earth and on every bird of the sky, with everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are given. Every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. I give all to you as I gave the green plant. Only you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is its blood. Surely I will require your life blood. From every beast I will require it, and from every man, from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. As for you, be fruitful and multiply, populate the earth abundantly and multiply in it." Then God spoke to Noah and to his sons and with him, saying, "Now behold, I myself do establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you. Of all that comes out of the ark, even every beast of the earth, I establish my covenant with you, and all flesh shall never again be cut off by the water of the flood, neither shall there again be a flood to destroy the earth." God said, "This is the sign of the covenant which I am making between me and you, and every living creature that is with you for all successive generations. I set my bow in the cloud, and it will be for a sign, for the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. It shall come about when I bring a cloud over the earth that the bow will be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant which is between me and you, and every living creature of all flesh, and never again shall the water become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the cloud, then I will look upon it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth." And God said to Noah, "This is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth." As you can see, the section is completely dedicated to God's initiative with mankind. That after the destruction of the world by the waters of judgment, man is now offered a new beginning. God blessed Noah, the chapter begins. Man is now given a second chance. He is allowed, in a sense, to go back to square one. And once again, he is supplied a world in which to live, a world over which he is to exercise dominion, a world in which he is to exercise his own stewardship. In spite of man's great depravity, God remains faithful. He has not abandoned mankind, but instead remains merciful to him. And you'll notice, hopefully, in there that there were a number of words and phrases that were reminiscent of Genesis chapters 1 and 2 in the account of the creation. Here we see the world is ready for a new start, that the slate has been wiped clean. And God not only renews his blessings to mankind, but he entrusts the responsibility of his creation into the hands of beings who have already spoiled it once as a result of their great evil. But there are great changes that transpire from the original situation. From this point forward, God is going to be known as the covenant-making and the covenant-keeping God. Like those that would come later, this covenant has stipulations, and there are stipulations to man, and there are promises and signs that come from God. It is a section that answers a couple of perhaps unanswered questions. One of them is, does God hold human life to be cheap? Is taking human life considered to be a small thing? After all, God has wiped out the entirety of humanity with the exception of 8 souls. And yet here, God declares very clearly that human life is sacred, that in a sense it belongs to him. That the old world had been marked out by violence, and now in this new world, blood is to be viewed as something that is incredibly valuable. And therefore, human beings must never eat the blood, Nor should they ever shed the blood, innocent blood of their fellow man. And if they should do so, God states very clearly that they open themselves up to having their own lives taken. Now, the first 17 verses here fall really into two main parts, and each one of them possesses its own message, and yet it clearly comprises a single unit in the address. You'll notice that in verse 1 and in verse 7, there is what scholars refer to as an inclusio. It's a way of that ancient writers used, since they didn't have paragraphs and punctuation, to set apart certain passages as units. And so we find in chapter 9 and verse 1 that there is this reference to being fruitful and multiplying that starts the section. And then in verse 7, another reference to being fruitful and multiplying that closes the section. In verse 8, we find a reference to God speaking to Noah. And then as the section closes in verse 17, we find God once again speaking to Noah. Two parts to this as God talks about establishing a new order. And he, first of all, establishes this new order through divine blessing. He pronounces blessing on another Adam, if you will. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. That the first blessings that were given to Adam, the first man, are now given again to Noah. By the way, this is the third time in man's existence that he has been told to be fruitful, emphasis on quality, and to multiply, emphasis on quantity. We saw it, it's back in chapter 1 and verse 28, and also in chapter 8 and verse 17. And yet, not everything is as it was in the beginning. In chapter 1 and verse 28, man was given the authority to rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, the things that moved on the earth. In chapter 1 and verse 31, we are told there that as God surveyed everything, he saw that it was very good. But now Noah is told that the fear and the dread of man will be upon every one of those creatures, and for good reason, because they now become hunted prey. They are now at humanity's disposal for food. And therefore, as the animals fear man, and there is some discussion among scholars as to whether this is talking only about wild animals or domesticated ones, but it seems to be making the point of emphasis here that man still, in his provision of food, is going to find it as a challenge. That man's rule over the earth is not simply granted to him, but there is a sense in which it is struggled for, if you will. Now, there's some that suggest that since man, back in the book of Genesis, it seems, ate only from plants, that what that means is that vegetarianism is the ideal. And that God only granted man permission to eat meat as a concession for man's sin. And yet, God never grants a concession that allows for something immoral or something sinful. To do that would compromise his integrity, and therefore, the very most that we can make out of this is that the eating of vegetables or plants only may be the ideal. And yet, that's even a stretch. In the law of Moses, God will actually command certain sacrifices not simply to be brought, but to be participated in. That is, to be eaten by the worshiper. And therefore, God, in that case, doesn't simply tolerate the eating of meat. Instead, he actually requires the eating of meat. Later in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul will give instruction in regard to eating meat that had been sacrificed to idols. And so it simply isn't true that vegetarianism is the biblically ideal diet. Doesn't that make you feel better? It's simply a way of living. If being a vegetarian or being a vegan, if that makes you feel better, if that helps you in your life, then you have the choice, you can make that choice. But it's not more moral. It's not more in keeping with God's plan. It's not God's ideal way of doing things. Instead, God provides all food. Paul will make that point in 1 Timothy chapter 4. He's given it all for our goodness, for our blessing, to be enjoyed, to be thanked, as God provides it to us. But in this permission that man now has to eat meat, he is, in a sense, given the power of life and death, especially over the animals. And so there are a couple of stipulations that are brought to man's attention. First, it is to be a moving thing. And what that seems to indicate here is that man is to take an animal that is alive and take its life, as opposed to eating meat of an animal that has died of natural causes or that was, torn up by a predator of another kind. And secondly, there is a prohibition on the consumption of blood. That when the moving thing is killed, that the blood is to be drained before it is consumed. That not only is all life significant to God, but its blood, its lifeblood, is in a sense God's property. And thus, in man moving forward, there is to be this recognition that they have taken the life of the animal with God's permission, and that they are partaking of God's bounty as His guests. And therefore, they respond by demonstrating a respect for life and God's newly established order. Later in the law, Leviticus 17 and verse 14, Moses would write, "For as for the life of all flesh, its blood is identified with its life. Therefore I said to the sons of Israel, you are not to eat the blood of any flesh. For the life of all flesh is its blood. Whoever eats it shall be cut off." But while an animal's blood could be shed but not consumed, Moses is told that man's blood must never even be shed. And therefore there is this distinction drawn between human life and all other living creatures. Human life is given special protection there in verses 5 and 6. "Surely I will require your lifeblood. From every beast I will require it. And from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man." Three times in a single verse, God says, "I'll require it of you." Divine retribution is threatened upon animals who take human life, and we see that borne out in the law. Exodus chapter 21, verses 28 and 29, an example of that, that if an ox kills a human being, that ox is to be put to death. And therefore, how much more a man who kills an innocent man? By the way, this is the first use of the word brother since Genesis chapter 4. And there in Genesis 4, it was used on numerous occasions to show the incongruity of the actions of Cain taking the life of his brother Abel. That there is no sin that shows more contempt for human life and therefore for God than that of murder. And God declares the reason here. That God has made man in his own image. Another echo of Genesis chapter 1. That man occupies a unique status among all of God's creatures, and therefore he is to be specially protected. That if one human being takes the life of another human being, then God requires the forfeiture of that person's life. It is an assault not just on the other human, but it is, in a sense, an assault on God himself. And yet in our enlightened culture, animals are often protected over the lives of people. Capital punishment has been deemed to be inhumane. And yet here, God places the great responsibility of exercising divine judgment and puts it into human hands. Now, he's not advocating lynch mobs or vigilante justice or personal vendettas. What he is, however, prescribing is duly designated individuals and entities carrying out the fulfillment of the divine will in terms of judgment upon those who would murder someone else. And though these actions we would think are put in place to protect human society, that's not the reason that God gives. Instead, God gives the reason that murder defaces the king's image. And therefore, murder is a kind of treason among men. It is a demonstration of hatred against not that other person, but against God himself, because that person is made in man's image, or made in God's image. The pre-flood world, you remember, was marked out by wickedness and violence. And in this new world, that is not to continue unchecked. Instead, man is instructed that he must safeguard life. Not just in how he goes about eating the meat of animals, but how he views and preserves human life. Now, you and I, we might be thinking to ourselves, wouldn't it just be easier if God took the punishment into his own hands? After all, there would be no long trials. There would be no hung juries. There would be no innocent people on death row. There would be no endless searches for criminals who are never caught. There would never be the heartbreak of those who when guilty, go unpunished. But in this delegating responsibility, God, he's not looking to abdicate his role. He's not looking to be less involved in the realm of humanity. This is a step that's taken for our benefit. There are distinct advantages to be realized when society takes responsibility for itself, that it enforces laws for the good of society, that it carries out the punishments in terms of the violations of those laws. And therefore, it's through this avenue that God wants man to learn the value and the skills of dispensing justice. And he leaves us free either to succeed or to fail. The second part of the text, beginning in verse 8, focuses on the divine covenant. And you'll notice in those verses that there are seven occurrences of the word covenant. Perhaps the closest concept that we could get to is that, at least in our culture, of a legal contract. Both a covenant and a contract formalize an agreement made between two parties. That agreement may involve stipulations for both parties. It may involve stipulations only for one of the parties in mind. And here the term is used for God in terms of a formal promise that he makes to never destroy the world with a flood. And in this case, there is an agreement that is made, but stipulations only involve one of the parties. It is, therefore, an unconditional covenant, if you will. It's not dependent upon human response. It's not hinged to human obedience. And therefore, it's surprising for a few reasons. First of all, that God even bothered to begin with. Think about what man has done with the planet. Think about the intentions of man's thought prior to the flood. That man has demonstrated himself to be so great and mankind so evil. That God is so lovely and man is so ugly. That God is so giving and man is so grasping. That God is so appreciative and mankind is so thankless. Why bother making an agreement with mankind? And the only answer we can come up with is because of God's great love for us. Secondly, I want you to notice that it is God who takes the initiative. You see it in verse 11, verse 12, and verse 17. And Noah here, he's not in any position to coerce God or to obligate God. He's not able to compel God to somehow negotiate the terms of this agreement. This is not an agreement that's made between equal parties, but instead one where God is the one who sets the terms. God is the one who makes the promises. This is the image of a gracious God who brings himself into a covenant with those of his creation who have no collateral, who have no negotiating power, and who may, and as we'll see next time, will fall into evil. The third thing that I want us to notice here is that what God is seeking via this covenant is loving fellowship. The two parties involved are, by means of this covenant, brought into a relationship with one another. They enter into a fellowship. And in that sense, this covenant is not something that stands between God and man, but rather it is the means that brings God and man together into a partnership, a communion. And it is here that God institutes this covenant in order to express his gracious provision of protection. The divine assurance to not just man, but all of creation in regard to his preservation of the world, at least in terms of a flood. The content of the covenant is stated in verse 11. I establish my covenant with you, and all flesh shall never again be cut off by water of the flood, neither shall there again be a flood to destroy the earth. Now, it's very likely that there was some kind of a covenant that had been formed between God and Adam, but we're never told that. This is the first of many covenants that are found from this point forward in biblical history. This is the first one that is specifically referenced in Scripture. And what it answers is the question that mankind might have. If I go through the effort of multiplying and being fruitful and filling the earth, will it all that effort simply be brought to nothing by another flood? And God, in this covenant, makes the assurance that that will never happen again. And God Himself declares it to be so. In fact, He confirms it in verses 12 through 17. And it's here that the account of the flood really reaches its triumphal and hopeful conclusion. We won't take the time to do it, but in verses 12 going down through verse 17, there is a repetition of a number of words and concepts that were seen back prior to the flood in Genesis chapter 6. And yet here, the terms are set in a much more positive context. You'll also notice that there are five uses of the phrase between me and someone else. And so in verse 12, between me and you. Verse 15, between me and you. Verse 16, between God and every living creature of all flesh. Verse 17, between me and all flesh. It defines the partnership in terms of this agreement. But God does more than just make the agreement. He provides a sign. And there have been a variety of signs that you read about in Scripture. All of them, by the way, appointed by God. All of them intended to remind God or remind man of God's presence and God's promises, of His God-given obligations. This one is unique in that this is one that is actually given to remind God. It is an agreement that will be for all successive generations, there in verse 12, literally generations of eternity. Verse 16, it's described as an everlasting covenant. Twice, once in verse 11 and once in verse 15, God declares, never again will there be a flood of the earth. Never again will there be a global flood. Not in 100 years, not in 1,000 years, not in 10,000 years. You and I, we have trouble remembering promises we made last month. Or as a few years pass, circumstances change, things happen, and so we retract or we renege on a promise that we made. When mankind makes plans, when mankind utters promises, they may or may not keep them. But here we find God standing in the days of Noah and looking out into man's history, out into the future. And God at that time could honestly say, never in a million years will that happen. And mean every word of it. God is eternal, and therefore you and I, we may make a promise, but our promise only lasts at the very longest till we die. God makes a promise that is eternal. The sign that is given is that of a bow in the cloud. Now obviously there's this connection between the bow and the presence of rain. But there's an added significance here in that this is actually the same word that's used to describe a bow as a weapon. And so there is a sense in which God now is hanging up His bow. He's hanging up His weapon of war, if you will. And you and I know that there are a few sights that are more moving and more powerful than the dazzling brilliance of a full rainbow set against a dark, threatening cloud. Now, in that, there certainly is a natural order of things, isn't there? There's the physics of light and refraction. And it's certainly true that rainbows are the source of numerous myths and legends. But what we find here in Genesis chapter 9 is the truth about rainbows. Scientists, what they look at a rainbow, what they see is the sun, the light of the sun, reflecting and refracting through the raindrops. Superstition looks at a rainbow and it sees a sign of good luck. It sees that there is this massive box of lucky charms at the opposite end of the rainbow. But here we find the reality about the rainbow. It's the reality because it comes to us from God. That the beauty of the natural phenomenon of a rainbow points actually beyond itself to the God of creation and the God of covenant, the God of promise, the God of proclamation. That here is the covenant man Noah and his family, who have been kept safe from the storm by remaining inside of the ark. And now they are told that they can live freely. They can live without fear of a repeat of the flood. And they can do that outside of the ark. And God has given His assurance that He will keep His promise. And every time you and I see a rainbow in the sky, it's not so much there to remind us of the covenant, though it does, but to remind God of the covenant. The account of the flood in the days of Noah, a marvelous example of both justice and grace, of law and mercy, of proclamation and promise. Man, because of his sin, is judged. And it is a righteous man and his family who exit the ark safely. And as they do so, man has been enabled to begin again in an environment that has been completely cleansed and clean. He can now start anew. The slate has been wiped clean. He can start all over again. And so can we. Because ultimately that's the promise of the gospel, isn't it? That you and I can start clean. That having lived a life of sin, deserving the punishment of God, that by way of water, we can come to have a relationship with Him. To step, in a sense, out into a new environment with a new life. To have the slate wiped clean and to begin all over again. And tonight, if that's a step that you need to take, there's no better time than now. Take that step. This very evening, why together we stand, why together we sing.